Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Inside Writing. This show is presented by Gotham Writers, offering writing classes of all types and sizes. You can visit us at gothamwriters.com. Before we get started, a few announcements. Firstly, the Gotham Writers Conference is officially open for registration. So if you want a peek behind the publishing curtain, this is the place to be. It's going to be October 15th through 17th. Doubly so, if you have a project you're ready to discuss with agents, you can check out more details on the Gotham website on that as well. Okay, regarding today, at any point in the show, you can use the Q&A function to get your questions in for the panelists. So most of you are familiar with Zoom, but if this is your first time, on the dashboard there, you will see a Q&A button. The sooner you get those questions in, the better. We've been getting a lot of questions in lately, so we've been cutting to questions sooner. So get those questions in early. There's also a chat down there. That's for general discussion among all of you participants out there. So remember, keep your questions in the Q&A, keep your chat in the chat. Lastly, if you want to get caught up on any episodes of Inside Writing, you can find them all on the Gotham Writers YouTube channel or on any major podcasting platform. And while you're there, like us, subscribe, leave a review. It helps to spread the word. So today, the subject of the day is the creative pivot or shifting into a creative lifestyle. We're going to start with a quote from Paulo Coelho, who said, "One day you will wake up and there won't be any more time to do the things you've always wanted. Do it now." We'll talk more about that later. Now let's meet our panelists. Our first panelist, author of the novels, The Wild Woman's Guide to Traveling the World, How to Hack a Heartbreak, She's Faking It, My Epic Spring Breakup, and Life Unscheduled, Kristen Rockaway. Hello, Kristen. Hi there.
Hi.
And our second panelist, a former producer, staff writer, or contributing writer for The Late Late Show on CBS, Tough Crowd with Colin Quinn, and more, as well as a comedy writer who has written humor for celebrities and politicians, including a U.S. president, Bruce Cherry. Hello, Bruce.
How you doing?
Hi there. Thank you both for being here. So I want to start the question. Kristen, we'll start with you. Without something to define today, I want to ask you about that decision point, that moment when you decided that enough was enough and it was time to focus more on your writing to sort of push that into more of a full-time aspect. So even if it wasn't like an aha epiphany moment, when did that happen for you? When did you decide it was time to be more serious about your writing?
Yeah, it definitely wasn't a one specific point. It was kind of more like a snowball, like I was building and building basically my entire life. You know, I always wanted to be a writer, felt like that was my dream job when I was a kid. But, you know, it doesn't really pay very well. And I was really focused on having a steady job with health insurance and things of that nature. So I never really considered it as a serious career. So I wound up becoming a software engineer, which I really liked. I majored in computer science. And there are a surprising number of parallels I could draw between computer programming and writing, but I'll save that for another day. But anyway, I was a programmer for about 15 years. And in the last, I liked it in the first, you know, maybe decade. I was like, okay, you know, this is good. But there was like a growing sort of unease, a growing sort of feeling like I'm missing something and this isn't what I want to do with my whole life kind of thing. And then I had my son who was 8. And after that, I would always write kind of on the side for fun. It was just the way to fulfill my soul, you know? But once I had my son, I didn't really have that time. I didn't have a lot of time for myself in general. So I actually decided to take a Gotham Writers Workshop class when he was 8 months old. And even though I didn't have a lot of time, I would work full time, I'd take care of him. And then when he would go to sleep at night, I would spend however much time I could working on my Gotham. I took a fiction one, which is what I'm teaching now. And I really felt like I was reconnecting to myself. I was reconnecting to something very important that I had let fall by the wayside for way too long. And the more time I spent writing, the more dissatisfied I became with my full-time job. And it took about, from the time I took that class to the time I quit my job, it probably took about a year and a half. Where I was constantly working on a novel and I thought, started getting very serious about it. I thought this is something, maybe I'll just take 6 months off I'll take 6 months off and finish my novel and then I'll go back to it. But the way things unfurled, I just never had to go back.
Mm-hmm. Bruce, what about you? What was your process like? Was it spontaneous? Was it a moment or was it a buildup?
Well, I always had a pretty hippy-dippy passive kind of approach to how your life unfolds. And I just figured, I didn't have any career plans leaving college. I had a broadcast journalism degree, and I'm not exactly on-camera news material. So I just sort of like drifted to whatever jobs I got. And I ended up, of all things, being an accountant, a payroll supervisor, despite having no training whatsoever in accounting. And so I found myself, because of that sort of aimlessness, I found myself like in my early 30s, like with a cushy job as a payroll supervisor for a PBS station. And I was pretty much very much unfulfilled, but I didn't really mind it because I just came from a background where you work and you pay the rent. So I wasn't too concerned that my job wasn't giving me a lot of self-satisfaction. And then I started doing stand-up comedy just on a lark, and it really helped me a lot. I'm a very poor performer. Somebody early on in my career, after I did a set, said, "Man, you're terrible on stage, but you write great jokes." And I got a reputation for being able to really write great stuff. And then when I was about 32, I lost the cushy job and I ended up in a payroll supervisor job I hated. And then I was also given, like, some friends of mine that were in the comedy world were working, that was back in the 90s, and it was the first Silicon Valley boom. Not the first is probably the 50s, but you know what I mean. It was the late 90s tech boom. And there were all these projects for like these humor like projects on the interwebs that was brand new at the time and everything. And I got offered an 8-week position. The first thing, there's some friends of mine were taking part in this, like, really in this recording session for stuff that they had written for this CD-ROM manufacturer, and they invited me to be part of the recording session. I was there at the fantasy studios, okay, where Creedence Clearwater Revival recorded. I'm showing my age, like that doesn't show. But in any case, it was just the funnest thing in the world. I'm like, people get paid to do this? And I just thought, this is what I want to do. And then the person in charge said, "Well, I got this thing, it's 8 weeks." I quit my job for that, which was kind of hard, but I had a very supportive girlfriend at the time. And I just went for it. And that was, 20 some years ago. I've been able to make a living as a writer since, even though there have been some tough times here and there. It's the best decision I ever made.
So you both touched on things I want to get back to, but I want to talk more about, did you plan ahead? Bruce, I want to start with you. Did you plan ahead, or it sounds like you were in this moment and then you just decided, okay, this is it. How did you plan for a life without a cushy job? Did you plan for it, or did you just kind of see where it goes?
Well, I think, see where it goes is what got me into the dead end. So as soon as I when I had that first job for the first time in my life, when I was an accountant, I didn't, like I said, there's that, just that mentality of like you work, you get your paycheck, you go home, and then you do something fulfilling or whatever that you do as for artistic release. When I first started that job, I kind of realized that if I want this and I really love it, I have to work really hard at that. I've never worked hard at being an accountant. I just like, okay, fine. I'm very Protestant work ethic oriented, and I did a good job, but I wasn't like trying to scratch my way up to controller or CFO or something, because I couldn't have those things because I didn't have any training in accounting. So, but writing, I suddenly I tried really hard and I was very, very focused. And when I was out of work, I would do things like when somebody offered me a possible job, you have to submit packets for TV shows. And it's a lot of work for absolutely no return usually. And even once I'm like, this is impossible for me to get, I would do a good packet just so the person who recommended me would say, oh, I told him about that and he responded. So I started working really hard at things and enjoying doing it. So it really, to me, it really invigorated my, well, professional life. Before that, I really didn't have a professional life. I just had a like survival life.
Gotcha. So Kristen, what about you? Was there any planning ahead? Was there, because it sounds like you sort of inched into it a little bit, but was this something that you planned for? And what were some of the obstacles you ran into?
Yes, it's funny how different my approach was. I am very much a planner. And I mean, as evidenced by the fact that like, I wouldn't even consider writing initially as my first job, right? Because I was very much budget oriented and, you know, these are the things I need to pay back my student loans and things of that nature. So I, you know, as a software engineer, I made pretty good money, you know. I don't make that kind of money anymore as a writer. But I always, even though I never had these set plans to become a writer, I knew that this wasn't something I was going to do my whole life. Somewhere in the back of my mind, I knew I couldn't do this forever. So I lived well below my means. Like, I bought a smaller house. I didn't spend all my, I sacked away tons of money. So that when I finally got to this point where it came to the front of my mind and I was like, no, this is time. It's time to do this. I had that cushion, you know, I had that cushion. So I'd been saving for a long time. And when I said, you know, it took about a year and a half for me to realize this is what I want to do. Cause I am not the kind of person to just jump without, you know, there's that saying like jump and the wings will sprout. Like, that's not me. Like, I need to make sure there is a trampoline and then maybe like one of those giant, like puffy things that stunt people jump into. Like, I need to have several safety nets. So, you know, I carefully budgeted myself. I made sure I had enough money to last me for so long because at that point I hadn't signed with an agent. I had no, you know, and it was just a 6 month to me. I was saying in my head, this is just going to be 6 months. I'm just going to take 6 months. And of course, as Bruce kind of touched on, I have a very supportive husband who is he went through his own career change. He was an attorney at a big law firm and then decided to become a math teacher. So he kind of went through his, you know, big career change. And then it was kind of my turn to do that. And he was very supportive. We have health insurance and, you know, he's still very supportive of that. So there was a lot of prep work, a lot of journaling, you know, a lot of budgeting. Like that.
So I'm curious, because you and Bruce have both mentioned this sort of when you were first acquainted with writing, it felt like something clicked on, like this was something you knew you had to do. Was it that way for you, Kristen? When did you first discover writing? When did you start writing?
Oh, I mean, when I was a kid, like what I still have a little book of when I was like four or something, when I first learned to write, I wrote a little story about like these French cows that lived on a farm and, you know, they got into some hijinks and I drew it in pencil and stapled it together, you know? And then as I got older, in high school, I took the playwriting class. I had a play developed. I was on the literary magazine and the newspaper. And, it's funny, like what I, but even though all these signs were pointing to what I needed to, you know, what I was meant to do, I still would not allow myself to indulge. I felt it was an indulging. I was indulging it. I still needed to do it. So I always kept a journal. And then I discovered in the early days of blogging, a live journal. I don't know if anyone is familiar with that. I had a live journal, which is kind of like pre-Tumblr-esque. And that's kind of how I would write like these funny, like humorous essays, things like that. It really wasn't until I took the Gotham course that I said, you know what, I only have one life kind of thing. Like you were saying in the intro, I have one life and I'm getting older and I want to really take some formal courses and see what happens and see if I really have any chance of making this happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Along those lines, as Kristen was mentioning, I think that I became aware, I mentioned that other people told me like, you're a writer as opposed to a performer. And like, I noticed that when other, I I took great pride in writing like the best possible jokes I could. And my fulfillment was getting a laugh, even if I was on stage. I only performed in the sense of getting the joke out there. And if other people would like give me lines, we comics help each other out with things. And when I would get a line from someone else, it always worked. It was just, it was never quite as satisfactory, because even though it would kill and it would like help your set and everything, I'd be like, ah, oh, Kevin gave me that line. You know, it's not, it, I didn't write that one. And then if I would give lines to other comics, which I did a lot, and I would be sitting in the back of the room and I'm like, Derek is killing with my joke. And I would be more happy seeing a joke of mine work than I would be succeeding myself with someone else's joke. So I realized like, oh, I just want to like write. And I didn't pay any attention. Other comics would like work very hard on their performing skills, and I just put that aside and kept writing. And then I would reread and work on my stuff for hours and then go up and do a very half-assed performance, which is I ended up as a writer.
So do you think, sorry, I have a question. Do you think that the writing is what drew you to stand-up comedy in the first place, the creation of the jokes?
I'll tell you what, it's the adrenaline of being on stage. I'm not good on stage, but it's fun. You know, it's just like, you don't have to be a great basketball player to really enjoy playing basketball. And I just loved being on stage, even though the audiences were sometimes not as enthusiastic.
No, that was a good question. And Bruce, I want to kind of talk about, because, you know, it really sounds like once you made that pivot into this, into focus on being a writer, that was it. So what were some of the obstacles? Did you ever have any rough patches or moments where you doubted if this was the right choice?
Constantly. I didn't want to give the impression earlier I had this like hippy dippy sort of like, oh, life will work out thing, but I do have like a pretty OCD approach to things. And I tell you, there's a lot of times that one of the things that really held me back was I didn't start until I was in my 30s, and most stand-ups start in their 20s, and the ones that are like take the writing path have like staff jobs well before they're 30. And I didn't get like staff. I was doing comedy when I was 30. I didn't get writing jobs. It takes a while to get a reputation until I was almost 40 to get staff jobs. So that I was always the oldest guy on the bill and the oldest person in the writer's room, even when I was in my 30s. It's a game of like 20-year-olds. So that was the big obstacle for me. Fortunately, the thing that saved me was I'm very interested and drawn to politics, the one section of comedy writing that doesn't ding you if you're an old person is political or topical comedy. So in fact, it's better to be a gray beard when it comes to that sometimes. So thank God I had that niche, because I can't, you know, there's no way I can show up for an interview at Saturday Night Live and have them go, well, do you want to be an extra?
Kristen, what about you? What are some of the obstacles you've run into? And I guess a follow-up to that, and Bruce, I'll get your take on this as well, is have those obstacles gotten easier over the years, since you've become a full-time writer?
Yeah, it's funny. I was actually going to respond to that question by saying I still face the obstacles and the challenges. You know, initially, because I write novels, right? So that's all about writing, querying agents, which is writing a letter to an agent being like, this is a book I wrote, and, you know, maybe you'd be interested in representing me. And you write a whole bunch of those and you get 100 rejections, and then you get one yes, and that's all it takes, is just one yes. But that's just the first hurdle. Then the agent will make you, sometimes they'll make you edit, and then they will submit it to publishers who, you know, she'll do the same process of like, my client wrote a letter, you know, wrote a novel, perhaps you'd like to publish it, and then there'll be 100 rejections, and all it takes is one yes. And sometimes you'll be lucky and there'll be like a couple of yeses, and then they could kind of like, you could maybe get a little bit more money for that book, but most of the time it's just one yes. And just because you publish one book, like you think like, oh, that's it, I made it. No, no. Like there, you have to, if you want to keep at it, you got to write another book. And unless you got, you know, even if you have a 2-book deal after that second book, you still have to, you know, your editor may not like the book that you're wanting, or maybe your editor moves to a different publishing house, or maybe their finance, you know, they just change their strategy up in marketing and it has nothing to do with you or your writing. So there's a lot that goes, you face rejection constantly. And it's hard not to take that personally. Like you have to, I would always allow myself, like when I was querying, especially, I would allow myself every time I got a rejection, a couple hours just to like mope and feel so bad about myself. And then I'd be like, okay, time to send another query. You know, you have to have this persistent, not taking it personally kind of thing. You know, you're always going to get bad reviews. You're always going to get someone that doesn't, you know, just doesn't like what you write, but you're not writing for everyone, right? You're writing for the people that connect with your work. And if you're lucky, there'll be those people, and some of those people be in the right places that could get you published. So it's really kind of zooming out and taking it reminding myself that it's about the art, it's about the writing, it's you know, and trying to block out all this business stuff, you know, and not taking those rejections personally, knowing that it's a business.
Bruce, what about you? Has it gotten easier over time?
Well, just when Kristen was talking about rejection, I just remember that I don't perform that much anymore. But I just remember, like, sometimes, like, being on stage, you would just be, like, despised by audiences. And it really gives you, like, a harder shell. I realized, like, you know, I used to be, like, frightened to ask a girl out. And it's like, now I've been rejected by entire crowds. You know, who cares on the individual level, you know? But yeah, I think it's just, I think as the years go by, I use the, like I was intimating earlier, my biggest challenge is the fact that I started late. And so I tend to be demographically older than the people that I'm competing with. But I sort of look at it because I'm an old baseball fan, like a fastballer that lost, I may have lost my fastball, but I can work on like a knuckleball. Which is what old pitchers do. And that's just kind of fun. And it's sort of like a challenge to work within the parameters of your art form, if it's a novel or a painting. And in another sense, it's a challenge to work within the parameters of your age and just say, okay, I'm 63, but I can still do this, that, or that.
So next question, this might be kind of a dumb question, but I want to hear your answers anyway. So Bruce, do you feel like you could have had this writing career if you had a full-time job on top of it, or did you have to make that switch into dedicating full-time to it?
I think a person can easily have a full-time job and have a fulfilling writing and creative life. Millions of people do that all the time. It just makes it a lot easier to be able to make a living at it. And as Kristen was saying earlier, even if we're very fortunate to make living doing in creative endeavors, but we're both in a position where we have to respond to market forces and audiences and potential buyers and clients and bosses in some cases. So in a sense, you, even as a writer, you have a job, and you're lucky that your job is writing.
Mm-hmm. Kristen, what about you? Do you think you could have written, I think it's 5 novels now. Could you have done that with a full-time job?
Okay. So no, but that's because I have a child and it's just the nature of my life, but I don't want, just because I'm not capable of it, that does not mean, I mean, I will say the vast majority of my published author friends have full-time jobs. They do. They're software engineers. They are teachers. They're, you know, they have full-time jobs and they write novels. And a lot of them have like older kids or no kids. Some of them do it with small kids. I don't know how they do it. But it's absolutely possible. And you shouldn't think, well, I have this full-time job, so I can never write a novel. No, people make it happen all the time.
Mm-hmm. wasn't Herman Melville was a customs inspector down at the wharf.
That's great.
Still cranked out Moby Dick.
So I'm curious then, for people that want to make this pivot, Kristen, do you feel like anybody can do it? What, because it sounds like you both had a very supportive life that allowed you to do this. Are there certain parameters you have to have before you can make this creative pivot? Or what's your best advice to somebody who wants to make this pivot but doesn't know if they can?
It's so hard because you know already that I'm very much with, I have to have my finances in order and back, you know, my health insurance and things like that. So I don't want to encourage someone to just, oh, quit your job and, you know, then you'll get published, because like you might not right away. And even if you do, you might not make enough money to support yourself or pay the bills that you have to pay. I would really recommend that you have a plan in place, or, you know, a supportive partner is a plan, right? But yeah, that's
perfect. Yeah, no, that's a good answer.
To Kristen's point about that, I think we both, listening to her stories, we're both, like, neither of us were born to the manor born. We both had to do things. She talked about amassing a nest before you like take off. And I had to do the same thing. I worked very hard to have like a fallback cash position so that I could actually do the work. So I think we're both pretty much examples of people that didn't have an easy go of it. We weathered a lot of like effort to do this. It's just a matter of being focused about what you're doing. I think there are people obviously who are to the manor born and don't have to worry about making the rent or the mortgage or whatever, which is kind of, if I could, like, because I follow political things, I'm fascinated by the guaranteed minimum income, because I think that would unloose, it's too late for me, I'm not doing it for the $1,000 or whatever it is. But I'm just saying that would be wonderful for people that want to do creative things. It would just, more people would be able to do what they want, which would benefit society enormously, I think.
Absolutely. I think it would benefit the arts so much, because you think of how many people aren't writing that book or aren't, you know, sculpting or whatever their passion or their artistic passion is that they're not doing because they can't afford it.
Yeah. And as like a working class sort of person coming up through comedy and writing and everything, sometimes there's a lot of people who just live on trust funds or whatever. And sometimes you're tempted to be jealous of their situation there, but they're good people and they're talented people, but they're fortunate enough to have that sort of support system where they can follow their dream. If you can give like a minor support system via the government to everyone, I say, then do it.
Bruce, do you pull anything? I think Kristen mentioned this already, but Bruce, do you pull anything from your previous jobs into your creative life? Any like experiences into your writing?
Well, I tell you what, I always was never drawn to math. Obviously, like most writers, I was drawn to the English and liberal arts sort of things, and I ended up in a very math-oriented profession. But I'm very focused in terms of, like, it was very fulfilling. Payroll, you have to get at the end, it has to be to the penny, or else, because it all goes to the IRS, all the reporting and everything. It's not like you're like, well, that was close. You have to work at it and work at it and work at it until every column is exactly the same. And I think that sort of attention to detail, and if I may, just the ability to put up with crap. If you work really hard at like an accounting job and there's no fulfillment in it, and you just like let things roll off you, you really have to do that as a creative person. Kristen was talking about rejection. You know, it's gonna like crush you, but you can't like let it like destroy you permanently. And sometimes you just, things go wrong. You worked on a project for months one time and they're just like, this isn't happening. And you're like, well, I did get paid. And you go on to the next one.
Kristen, what about you? You mentioned how you pull stuff from being a software engineer. Do you still do that, or what was that like?
Oh yeah. So a lot of my books, I think, well, not all of them, but a lot of my books are feature main characters who are women that work in IT. Mostly because I write like kind of romantic comedies, and when I didn't, there wasn't really a lot of representation of that when I was, you know, in the ones that I was reading. And also it was just what I know, right? What you know, right? So How to Hack a Heart, I have it right here. You can see the cover. It's a woman. And she codes. She actually writes an app that, so she dates online, which is something that I also took from my real life experience. I met my husband on the internet. And she writes this like app called Jerk Alert to allow other women to like warn other women about men who are like creepy on the internet, like sending inappropriate things or like just being jerks in general. So it's a romance, but it's also a lot of her conflict comes from being the only woman in her group, which when I first started as an intern, now there's much more representation of women in STEM fields. But when I started, I was like one of very few women in the lecture hall in college. I was the first woman in my group. I was like the intern and I was 20 and everyone else was a man, you know, only software engineer there. So I took a lot of those feelings and put them into and experiences. And put them into my writing. So if you are, you know, I think that having a full-time job is excellent fodder for your writing.
So then, Kristen, I'm curious then, we've kind of touched on this a little bit, but for people who are looking to get out of their full-time job, who maybe have built up a nest, how do you know when the time is right to make that step? Is there ever a time where it's just going to be the perfect time, or is it just kind of you do it?
No, I was terrified when I did it. And it took me like a couple, like I drafted my letter of resignation and then like didn't send it and redrafted it, you know? And then finally I think there was just like a sort of like a series of events that happened at work that were just very, I was becoming like angrier and angrier. I was just very angry all the time. And then like I yelled at someone and it was so not like me and I apologized. And then I was like, I think that this might be the time, you know, like I have reached a point where I am just like emotional. I'm emotionally unhealthy. And so like, that's when I sent my resignation letter. But then of course everyone freaked out and I was like, I'll give you 2 weeks. And they were like, please stay for 2 months. I'm like, fine.
Bruce, what about you? It sounds like once you got introduced to writing, it was like this is where I'm going. How much, you know, what was I forgot my own question now. Kristen, what did I ask you?
Oh, when did you know the time was right?
When did you know the time was right, Bruce?
I think I really knew the time was right. Well, as I mentioned before, there's a big difference between having a cushy job and a comfortable job and a good income. I was very, very like comfortable. I can't say I was happy and fulfilled, but I found fulfillment through like in the evenings I'd go out and perform comedy poorly. So I really enjoyed doing that. But the job itself didn't give me anything. A friend of mine used the term golden handcuffs about her own situation, where she has a great job and she can't quit to become a professional writer. Fortunately, just through random like shifting of employment situations, I lost that great job that I'd had for like 10 years. And I ended up taking another job that was like, oh, okay, this is the dark side of accounting. Where it was just like, oh my God, I hated it so much. And that's when things came up. So for me, there was no question, even though the guy said, you know, I can give you 8 weeks. And then it turned out I worked there for years. He said, maybe there'll be more, I don't know. I'm like, 8 weeks away from the job I have is great. So circumstances forced my hand and they forced it in a very serendipitous way.
It's funny. I was so unhappy in my job for so many years. I just kept waiting to get laid off because they kept doing like rounds of layoffs. I'm like, maybe this time, you know? And then
I think it was finally like they did like a massive round of layoffs where it might have been me, but it wasn't. And I was like, oh God, I'm never getting out of here unless I pull the trigger.
So before we get into audience questions, I want one more question. Bruce, you have any regrets? Anything you wish you could go back and tell yourself earlier? Anything you've learned along the way?
Well, I guess the operative word would be earlier. If I could relive my life, I would be like the people I know that just started doing, well, the performing aspects is how I got introduced to comedy. People that just, I have a lot of friends that started doing stand-up so early that they had to get parental permission to like perform in bars with alcohol or whatever. There's different states have different situations where if people are underage can work in a bar. I would definitely have attacked it at a much earlier age, but that wasn't the way it panned out. So, but my regret, that is a regret, but at the same time, I'm very, very happy that despite the extra hurdle that it took me to leave my comfortable lifestyle, I still did it. Instead of doing it when you just have all the vigor and focus and just joy of life at a 19 or 20 year old.
Mm-hmm. Kristen, what about you? Any regrets or things you wish you would have known sooner?
To be honest, no. I feel like if I had started earlier, I wouldn't have had the discipline or the self-confidence to have gotten A, finished a novel, or B, handled all that rejection. I probably would have, you know, I would have allowed myself to crumble under the rejection, I think, until I come about that hardened exterior from working in software for 15 years.
All right, so I'm going to get into some audience questions now. First one, Kristen, just a clarification, what is a live journal? Because I don't know.
Oh, live journal. It's like a blog, but like an early version of a blog. It was kind of like you made friends and you could like kind of lock it down. I mean, it was pretty much like social, like the first wave of social media, but it was very writing based. It was really about writing. And you know, people would write kind of like what was going on in their day. A lot of it would be journaling, but there was like people would write fiction. And, you know, I focused on kind of humorous essays. That was like my thing.
So next question, this will be for both of you. Bruce, I'm going to start with you. Most of us have a day job and a life schedule to work around. And even though I set aside consistent time to write, I find that my creative times don't always align with my scheduled opportunities to write. So my question is, how do you get your muse to wake up during the times you set aside for writing?
Well, in my situation, I don't really set it aside. I have clients and I have definite deadlines constantly every day. That's why when we were scheduling this, I had to be like, I have to absolutely be done by 1, because then I have to like immediately go just because there's something I got to get out by 2. And beyond that, then there's the thing that needs to be done by 5. So I actually, I don't set my own schedule at all. I do have a hand in like doing that by dint of what clients I take and how I negotiate when they get the stuff. But when I was writing just for myself as a performer, I would always write in the evenings. I don't have that luxury of doing it whenever I want to now. And I train myself to be able, I can get up. I'm not a morning person, but I can start it, run to the keyboard and start typing. So it's a discipline. You actually have to be more disciplined, I think. And Kristen can speak to this. I think you have to be more disciplined as a freelance and self-employed person than you do as an employee.
100%. Deadlines are an amazing invitation for a muse. I just read Writing Down the Bones. I can't believe I waited this long to read this book, but I don't know if anyone has read that. It's a really good book. I encourage anyone interested in, you know, any writer to read it. And she kind of talks about how, you know, you have this writing practice, like even if you don't want to, you show up because you have to give the opportunity, like even if your muse isn't there, you write and the muse will come, you're inviting the muse in, you know? So if you do believe in this concept of a muse, that you have to show up and show them that you're willing, and then the muse will meet you, you know? Because like he said, like, I don't have the luxury
of writing whenever I want. You know, in a few hours, my son will be home and then forget it. Like, I'll never be able to concentrate, you know? Try writing a sex scene when your 8-year old is like, "Mom, what you doing?" So I have to fit my writing into like a certain number of hours in the day. Now, when deadline comes, you know, I got a book due in a couple of months, then I'm just like, see ya. And like, I go to a hotel for a couple nights and like, mom doesn't exist. But yeah, you just have to, you know, you have to just show up and have that discipline. And even if you don't feel it, just write garbage on the page until, you know, you turn the faucet on to get the water flowing. That's what you got to do.
So next question, Kristen, this one's specifically for you. Would you say that after getting a rejection, it's best to send out another query with the least possible delay so we don't let our disappointment and frustration fester?
Well, I don't think that you should, you don't want to let your disappointment fester. However, you don't want to crush it either. You have to allow yourself to feel your feelings, acknowledge it and be like, this is really hard. Because if you don't, then it'll explode later on. And then you have to, allowing yourself to feel that disappointment will get you used to the rejection process and it will desensitize you to it after a while. So, you know, maybe the first time I needed a whole day to recover from my rejection and then I only needed a couple of hours, you know, but let yourself feel that feeling. And because it can also turn to like bitterness and you don't want to be bitter either. You know, you always want to have that kind of gratitude.
Unless you can channel the bitterness.
Bruce, just in general, what are your takes on rejection? How do you handle rejection? And do you feel like you've learned how to handle it better?
No. I am like really so the most thin-skinned person in the world, and I take everything personally, and that'll never change. And you just kind of learn to live with it, so it's actually not a problem. I realize I'll be like, oh, man, this is going to just eat away at me for weeks. And you just go on with your life like that, like someone who has like a skin rash or something, you know, like, well, this is going to be itchy, but I'll just do it. All right. So, I think that's probably a good thing for people to know, you know, it's possible to live with the disease of rejection, like sensitivity.
I will now forever think of rejection as a skin rash. So thank you for that, Bruce. That's good. Next question. Bruce, this one's specifically for you. It sounds like ageism is still prevalent in the writing world, perhaps more so in the humor writing side. Can an older person who is completely at the beginning of a career pivot overcome it? And if so, what's your best advice?
Well, I wouldn't call it ageism. I have to be fair as someone who's worked in this for a long time. If I was putting together a staff to like for a show that is directed towards people in their teens and 20s, I wouldn't want a bunch of me in the writer's room. I just don't, I can try as hard as I want to keep up, but I just don't have that visceral connection to like pop culture and the sort of references you have to make. So I don't think it's ageism per se, but you can get around it by going to different niches. Is it niches or niches? I shouldn't ask that on a live thing.
I think it's niches.
Niches? Okay, I had it right the first time. That's the writer's curse. You have a great vocabulary, but you get it by writing and not by interacting in conversation. And you're like, I actually don't know how to pronounce half the fancy words that I know. But now I lost my train of thought. Oh, you can overcome the fact that your age makes you less employable. Like I said, I went into political comedy. A good friend of mine passed away, but he started his writing career in his 70s. He retired and then like wrote a book and got it published about how much it sucked to get old. And he parlayed that into a career as a performer. His name was Richard Carter, a brilliant writer and a fantastic comedian. He ended up being on The Tonight Show like 8 times. He started trying to go to clubs and bars to promote his book, and he would do stand-up sets to just to do that, and it parlayed into a whole nother career. So yeah, it's out there. Give it a shot.
Next question. Kristen, well, this one's directed at you, and it's about querying again. So do you mind talking a little bit about, because the question is, do you only send out one query at a time waiting for the response? Just if you don't mind talking about your querying strategy a bit.
Yeah, sure. So I would never send out one query at a time because sometimes agents will take months to get back to you. And if you did that, you would, you know, you'd never, it's just not a good strategy. But you also don't want to, you know, send out 100 at once because you might not be the best query. So what I would do is I would send out 5 to 10 at a time, depending. I took a query letter writing class that I had like my best query letter forward. I would send out like 5 to 10 at a time, target my, you know, the agents I wanted to query. And once the rejection started rolling in, I would kind of look for patterns among them to be like, oh, you know, are they thinking, do they think that, you know, what are they seeing? Should I change this up? Are they not getting something? Am I saying something incorrectly? And then I would maybe tweak my letter and then send it out again, you know, and I would generally do a 1-for-1. Once I got a rejection, I would send another one out, you know, kind of thing. Cause most agents send it back in a reasonable amount of time, but you still have, especially like the bigger agents, you won't hear back. Sometimes you won't hear back for 3 months, 4 months. So. Mm-hmm.
Next question, Bruce, we'll start with you. And I'll say something about this question too. It's about writing groups. We're actually next week's episode on Inside Writing is about writing groups. So David, you should show up for that episode too. Bruce, question is, do either of you have any experience with writing groups? Are they helpful?
Yeah, I not so much a group, but like a partnership. I would get together with a couple of very good friends of mine for years, and you just bounce ideas off of each other, and it's the most fruitful thing in the world. And it's just as fulfilling to help somebody else out if they're like stuck in a corner as it is to have them do you a solid. So I highly recommended that or recommend it, but it's a little bit more difficult when that was back with other performers when I was still doing a lot of like performing, but it's harder because writers are so much more insular. You just don't have that sort of camaraderie. So I haven't done it for quite some time. I think that, and although it's not part of my experience, like a larger group situation would really, really be a helpful thing.
Mm-hmm. Kristen, what about you? What's your experience with writing groups?
So my first writing group actually came as a result of my first Gotham class, because there were like maybe 4 or 5 of us that started talking outside of the class. And, you know, we kind of connected with each other's writing. And so we started our own kind of online critique group where we would read, you know, one week we would submit and then give feedback. We'd follow kind of like the whole Gotham critique process. And it was really good. And then I started joining local writing groups. I started with the Romance Writers of America. I'm not a member of them anymore, but when I first started out, I was. And they're a local group in San Diego, and I met people through there, and we would sometimes get together and just, even though we were all writing novels, we were all writing our own stuff, and we didn't necessarily read each other's stuff. Something about sitting around a table with other writers, feeding off their energy, seeing, okay, I'm not, you know, because it's a very solitary endeavor writing a novel, and you can feel lost and like, why am I doing this? But when you see other people are going visually and like in the same room, you see them doing what you're doing, what, you know, the same thing, it can be very, on the other side of validating, you know, like, okay, what I'm doing, this is, other people are doing this too, and this is good, and we're, you know, just that energy. Mm-hmm.
So you've mentioned classes a few times. So I want to, there is somebody who's asking what classes you both teach. So Kristen, we'll start with you. What classes do you teach at Gotham?
Right now I'm just teaching Fiction 1. I'm not teaching it right now because I'm on deadline and I can't balance it. But I think after I send in my next book, I'll try to teach another one.
Gotcha. Bruce, what about you? What do you teach?
I've been teaching essay online pretty consistently every semester, in fact. I also teach humor, but I only taught that in person, and that's been kiboshed by the pandemic, obviously, and I haven't signed up for the Zoom classes. although this has been quite pleasant. So I was always a comedy and joke writer. And then at a certain point, one of my political clients said, well, can you just write the whole article instead of just punching it up and adding some jokes? I'm like, I guess so. And I started writing like op-eds under other people, ghostwriting op-eds. And so I began teaching essay as well, which is really fulfilling and fun. Mm-hmm.
Next question. Bruce, we'll start with you. What kinds of books or writings do you read to help improve your writing?
Boy, I tell you, I'm not real good at reading a lot of fiction. I've always been like a real history buff, and I read almost consistently nonfiction, but a lot of nonfiction writers are great writers. And like I said, I'm teaching essay, so a lot of writing actually is nonfiction. So I read historians that I really admire, and I try to, like Nathaniel Philbrook, I just read his Mayflower, which is just brilliant. And those people, when they do it right, they just, I think they write as well as fiction writers. Mm-hmm.
Kristen, what about you? You already mentioned writing down the bones. What other books or writings do you read to help?
Well, I try to read very widely. You know, I write romantic comedy, and so I tend to read a lot of those because I really have to keep up with the market and see what's going on, comparables, that kind of thing. And also I just really like them. But you know, I read a lot of other kinds of fiction too. I've just started getting into sci-fi and Afrofuturism. I just read Kindred by Octavia Butler, and that was incredible. I read short stories. I read a lot of nonfiction. In terms of writing, you know, just because it's really good to get a lot of good words in your head, no matter, you know, you always just surround yourself in good words in, good words out. In terms of writing books, writing down the bones, like I said, I just read it and it was incredible. I also really like The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield. He talks to writers, but it's kind of for any kind of artist, talks about resistance, pushing through that. When you sit down, you're like, I don't want to write. We were talking about the muse before, right? Like, oh, the muse isn't him. Well, you know what? You just got to sit down and write. And Bird by Bird by Anne Lamott is another classic. Mm-hmm.
Last question we have here in the queue. Kristen, it's for you. As a first-time author, did you hire an editor or have someone review your book before querying?
No. There are a lot of independent editors out there right now. If you're self-publishing, I definitely need an editor. But, you know, if you're publishing with traditional publisher, they have an editor for you. Like, that's why they, you know, that's how they make their money. Like, they have an editor for you. I took classes, right? And I had critique partners who would read my stories and give me feedback. It wasn't like I would just wrote the book with no other eyes on it and sent it in. I even workshopped my first book in a romance class, Gotham. So, yes, but do you need to pay an editor to do it for you? I'm not convinced, but definitely you want other people to read it.
So very last thing before we go, I want to give you both a chance. If you have anything to promote or where people can find you, if you're on social media or where they can see your body of work. Kristen, we'll start with you. I know you have a book handy, so I know you have something to
promote. Oh yeah, that was when I have all my books handy, but like this is my latest book. It just came out March 6th. This is my first young adult novel. It's called My Epic Spring Breakup. You can see it takes place in Brooklyn. And she is a coder in high school. So again, taken from my own life. And she went to the high school I went to in Brooklyn, Edward R. Murrow. And this book is Life Unscheduled. This is the cover. This isn't a final cover. It actually changed. It's going to look a little bit different. But this comes out September 1st. And you can find me at kristenrockaway.com or on Instagram at kristenrockaway. I've been kind of like hiding out on social media lately because I'm kind of burned out on it. But as soon as like promo is going to start for this, then I'm going to have to get it back up. So,
Bruce, what about you?
Well, as a ghostwriter, I am one of the like very few writers I'm like a ghost on social media. I technically have a Facebook account, but I don't advertise. I think one of the two things that a comedy ghostwriter does or offers a client is good writing, and then B, absolute just secrecy in terms of I never discuss who I write for or what I do. And so I don't have a website that lists people. That's another thing that kind of came through from my payroll days. You knew everybody's income and you just had to learn to keep your trap shut. And now as a ghostwriter, that skill comes in handy. I never discuss who I work for. So I don't even have a website with my name on it. I do own my name. I do own brucecherry.com, much to the chagrin of a dentist in Texas. But I never use it, which must drive him up a wall. Because I've seen Bruce Cherry DDS and it's quite well done. And I
probably is there a Bruce Cherry in the participants? Is he here? Is he list his grievance?
Yeah, he's stalking me. There's a dozen of me. Just as an aside, I had no idea the name was so popular until the internet existed. It's not popular. I assumed it was unique, but not at all.
All right. Well, to all of our listeners, thank you for being here. We're going to be back next week. Like I said, regular time, regular day, Wednesday at 1 p.m. We're going to be talking about writing groups. So see you there. Kristen, Bruce, thank you both so much for being here today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right. And we'll see you all next week.